That's why we haven't recorded things.
Baffled by the technology. Okay, so today we're moving on to the Dhammas section, which is the last section of the objects of awareness. So we've had body, vedana, citta, and now we've got Dhammas. It's quite a long section in the sutta. And it's a series of lists, basically, a series of Dhammic lists, then some of which probably have been added by later people, not by the Buddha. So the thing with Pali text, you never quite know whether it's the voice of the Buddha. But there's several different versions of the Satipatthana Sutta. And in all those versions, there's elements of the Dhamma section that are consistent. So we can safely assume they probably were the heart of the Dhamma section. And that's basically the hindrances and the awakening factors. So I'm going to say a little bit about those, very, very tiny bit about those. And then I'm going to move on to how we can relate to the Dhamma section practically and usefully, rather than just, you know, thinking we're following a list. So I'll just say briefly what the sections are in this version of the Satipatthana. There's the hindrances, there's the skandhas, or the five heaps that make up the all things in the world, or human beings, which is form, vedana, cognition, volitions, and consciousness. So the early Buddhists were very good at analysing things. So it's about, like, you take a human being, and then you realise a human being isn't a fixed and enduring thing, and what are the different elements that give us this delusion of having a self that continues through time. So we've got form, we've got vedana, we've got cognition, we've got actions, and we've got a sense of consciousness that binds all that together. There's the sense spheres, which is, I always find, rather difficult to say, especially if you say the six sense spheres. That'd be terrible if you had a lisp. The six sense spheres. So that's the idea. This is very interesting, actually. So you have an eye, or let's say you have an ear, so you have a sensing organ, and then you have the object that the ear hears, that we hear, and then there's a feta that arises. So the two things get yoked together, and you think that you are really hearing an independently existing sound. So I quite like this idea of feta. So we're continually sort of bonding with the outside world through our six sense spheres and deciding that we're living in this permanent and enduring world. So that's quite an interesting aspect of this, the sutta. There's the awakening factors. So a bit more about those in a moment. And then there's the Four Noble Truths. And then the Buddha goes on to say, if you practice all these teachings for 7 years, 7 months, 6 months, 4 months, 1 month, even 7 days, then you will gain awakening. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that's the general gist. Yeah. So he's saying it's a direct path, it's a complete path. If you follow it diligently, with love, with care, with clarity, with intelligence, then you'll free your mind from all suffering. So the hindrances and the awakening factors, that's a really nice, they're a very nice pair. So the hindrances is sensual desire. So hindrance means something that hinders awakening. So when we're caught up in sensuous desire, we're blocking our ability to be awake. There's aversion, pushing away. There's sloth and torpor, very lovely words. So it's when we're very sleepy, sluggish, dull. You know, if you're in that state of mind, you're not going to be having a moment of awakening because you're too lethargic. Then there's restlessness and anxiety, which is the opposite, which is where you're physically restless and mentally anxious. So those two are kind of energy pairs of too little energy and too disturbed energy. And then doubt, which is a sense of what am I doing here? It's a waste of time. I should have gone to Lanzarote. I can't gain awakening. I don't believe the Dharma anyway. It's a horrible hindrance because it's so insidious. It's a little bit like wading around in slime. You know, it's very hard to get out of when you've got doubt. Yeah. And the Buddha's saying that all the things that hinder us from awakening fall within one of these five categories. Yeah. I'm not quite sure where fear fits in, because I think fear is such a dominant thing for many of us. I've always wondered why fear isn't one of the root poisons in Buddhism. But anyway, the Buddha decided that these five was a pretty thorough and comprehensive list. And then the awakening factors is mindfulness, hopefully. Investigation of dhammas, which you can mean investigation of your subjective experience, like what is actually going on for you right now. Energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So it's a spiral path. It's another form of a spiral path. And if you reduce the hindrances, you build the awakening factor. So they map onto each other very nicely. So if you overcome sloth and torpor, you have energy. If you overcome doubt, you have mindfulness. Yeah. So it's quite natural. If you reduce the hindrances, you will be building the awakening factors and moving towards freedom. And equanimity, as the last awakening factor, is a very, very high level of attainment. So it's considered synonymous with enlightenment. So it's different from equanimity in the Brahmaviharas. So it's upekkha. So it's having a completely spacious, non-sticky mind. So nothing sticks. Imagine that. You're going through your life and you're having your experience. You're very alive. You're very present. But there's nothing within you that will snag against experience. Yeah. Be amazing, wouldn't it? Nothing snags. Because we're very snaggy most of the time. With the, I want this, I don't want that. It's as if we've got something inside us that's like Velcro and things are just kind of getting stuck. And which means that energy can't flow through us. We're not participating in life in harmony with what's around us. Yeah, that's something that you can maybe have a little bit of a go at when we do the mindful movement later on. I'm doing it a different way today. But just stand or sit and imagine that you're very full of space and the wind or the air is able to flow through you with no obstruction. It's a nice thing to do as a practice, that life is flowing through you with no obstruction. And I think that's something of a little bit of a taste of awakening. And we're using our imagination to do that, but that's really powerful because we're allowing ourselves to imagine something of the experience of awakening. So there was the reading that Papadarshini gave this morning. Moments of awakening are possible in any given moment. If we're attached to something, we're suffering. If we see that deeply enough, grasping falls away and we're liberated. Moments of awakening are possible in any given moment. If we're attached to something, we're suffering. If we see that deeply enough, grasping falls away and we're liberated. So this list of the hindrances and the awakening factors, essentially, it's what we've been talking about all week, which is moving from a tight fist of clinging or aversion to living life with open hands. So it's always this movement from contraction to release. That's the kind of felt thing we're looking for on the cushion in daily life. Where are the moments of holding and how can I soften around those moments of holding? Yeah. I think it, in a way, it really is that simple, hard to do, but we just practice, and then that becomes our default setting. So we're living with a much more open and fluid perspective. So the Dhamma section follows on from the Citta section, but where experience is analysed with more detail. So Subhuti has a very nice image for the Citta and Dhamma sections. So the Citta, where we're looking at the broad kind of emotional tone, it's as if we're up on a hilltop looking down over a big plain, and we've just got a general sense of the plain, of the landscape, of the animals, of the creatures, of the rivers, the trees. It's quite a broad awareness. And in the Dhamma section, we get out the binoculars and we're sort of zooming in on particular animals, particular trees, rivers, so we're able to examine our experience in more detail. So I think that's quite a nice image, the sort of broad sense and then the zooming in. So the thing we're trying to arrive at with the Dhamma section in particular is insight, which is seen as the one of the ways of talking about the goal in Buddhism, insight into the way things are. So we're able to see very directly the true nature of things. And of course it's been in the refrain all the way through the sutta, as I've talked about on other days. We see the arising and the passing, and both the arising and the passing away. So that's insight as well. But I'm just going to talk a little bit this morning about the lakshanas, which is one way of looking at insight, and secondly, seeing into the conditioned nature of everything, which is another way of talking about insight. There's various ways you can approach insight, but these are two very traditional kind of models that are helpful. So the lakshanas is essentially seeing that everything is impermanent, and the implication of that is that everything, including oneself, is empty of a fixed and enduring essence. So you've got impermanence, and then you've got insubstantiality, or no self. And then you've got dukkha, which is what arises when we don't live in harmony with that truth. And dukkha, it's often translated as suffering, which I think it's a bit unfortunate, because suffering is such a broad word in English. And of course, I used to think that if I gained insight, I would have no more physical suffering. And then I kept on having physical suffering, kept on thinking I was failing, and I didn't know how to practice. You know, the Buddha had physical suffering. So dukkha is much more unsatisfactoriness. I think that's a better word. And the traditional image is an ill-fitting wheel on a cart. So that's obviously an image from ancient India. So you're going along and this wheel is going clunk, clunk, clunk. So you're going along, but there's this kind of sense of discomfort. So that's what's meant by dukkha. You keep on trying to get your life perfect and it just keeps on being clunky. I wonder what a modern image would be. Can anyone think of a modern image of dukkha? Sorry?
A flat tire.
A flat tire. Oh yeah, very good. Yeah, so you're driving along and your wheel is going clunk.
Square peg in a round hole.
Square peg in a round hole, yeah.
Windows.
Sorry?
Windows operating system.
Oh, yeah. I think it's meaning Windows, and I was thinking, wow, that's deep. Windows. Like we're seeing, but we're not seeing because it's glass in the way. Yeah, Windows operating system.
Unsatisfactory cup of coffee.
Unsatisfactory cup of coffee. That's quite a good example. I mean, how many of us have sat down in a cafe with great longing that we are going to achieve eternal bliss with our tea and cake? And then, you know, the coffee's not quite right and the cake, there's not quite a big enough slice, and then it's gone. That's really irritating. So you think, you know, this coffee's going to satisfy you forever, or this cake, and then it's gone. Yeah. So that's what's meant by dukkha, and I think that's a really important point. It's not meaning all the difficulties in your life will go away, in the sense of physical suffering, getting old, all those kind of things. The Buddha had enormous physical suffering in his old age. So I spent years thinking that if I was a good Buddhist, my back pain would go away. I was particularly excited by the third noble truth, which is that there's an end to suffering. So I thought, yay, I want that. Thinking that it meant an end to any difficulty. And I think a lot of us make that mistake, and then we're so disappointed, and then we often think I'm doing something wrong, blame ourselves, and then start practicing in an even more willful way, or we give up. So those are the two things.
That's a perfect description of the Windows operating system.
That's true.
It's my fault.
That's true. Yeah, yeah.
Thank
you. We should write to Bill Gates and say thank you so much, you've given us this amazing dukkha practice. Yeah. So I think the lakshanas is a very nice model, it's a very good model. I think it's an accurate model, as far as I can tell. You know, seeing into impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha. But I'm increasingly thinking we need to hold all these things with a good chunk of don't know mind. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it seems a good system, I seem to be going deeper into it, I seem to be understanding more, and I can never really know it. I can't know it with my cognitive rational mind. Tenzin Palmo, who's the English woman who spent 12 years in a cave in Tibet. There's a book called Cave in the Snow, written by a journalist about her experience. really worth a read. She's a really remarkable woman, Tenzin Palmo. She says something really good, is that the more you realise, the more you realise there's nothing to realise. The more you realise, the more you realise there's nothing to realise. Yeah, so that's a great thing to turn over in your mind as a kind of koan. I think in the West, we're so achievement oriented. You know, it's part of our education system, it's part of the consumer society that we live in. We keep thinking we can go outside ourselves and get something that will fill our inner need. And we're quite, you know, we're well educated, we value education. So the acquisition of knowledge, we think, can solve our problems. But I don't think the Lakshanas are like that. I think they're operating on some other level. So the more you realise, the more you realise there's nothing to realise. So I've been thinking about this a lot this week, reflecting on the Satipatthana Sutta. So I've been diving deeply into the sutta. I realise it's 15 years now. It's been my main practice, along with Amitabha sadhana and love practices, because they're really important. But I found the Satipatthana Sutta very, very accessible, helpful, and accurate. So I feel like I've been given a map. So it's climbed down. You know, you've got a book, and then magically coming out of the book, this map of the human mind, and you're given all the ways, all the sort of routes to follow. It's very clearly signposted. You know, when you have this, do that. When you've got this experience, apply this next step. And I think it is an effective map of how to go more and more deeply into the present moment, into direct experience, and to see that there's nothing fixed and enduring, and to live more and more with flow. Yeah. I mean, it's no wonder it's one of the most widely studied and practiced texts in the Buddhist tradition, because it's brilliant. You know, I don't have any doubt about that. However, I'm beginning to think there is some dangers with it. I think what you can do is end up with a very, very refined sense of reductionism. So what you're doing with Satipatthana is you're kind of analysing your experience more and more and more, with more and more detail, and you're breaking everything down, a little bit like looking through a microscope, and coming closer and closer and closer to that sense of there's nothing there that's fixed and enduring, in me, outside of me, in other people. But I think because we're in this era now, where science is, for many people, the dominant religion. You know, there's many people now who live in an essentially secular world. And certainly I believe, you know, a lot of things that science tells me, I believe, about cells and blood and atoms and gravity even. You know, I believe that what Newton discovered is true. It may or may not be true, but we take on scientific truths quite uncritically, I think. So this idea of kind of going more into more and more detail, like looking through a microscope, that's quite appealing and attractive, I think, to the Western mind. But I think the danger is this refined reductionism and also a cognitive dominance, using the model that Nagasiri's presented this week of logos, mythos, and eros. You can approach Satipatthana practice in quite a logos dominated way. I don't know that I've done that. I may have done, but I certainly see that as, I've been aware of that as being a kind of near enemy of this practice. And what's happening with me now after 15 years is I'm increasingly interested in what lies beyond the map. So if you think of a map, you've got a bit of paper, haven't you, that's got all these kind of routes all over it. If you think of an Ordnance Survey map. But that map is resting in a context. So what I'm really interested in at the moment is what lies beyond the map, or what lies inside the map, or what lies above the map, or below the map, or around the map. It's a bit like if you go more and more deeply into something, into the sense of no thingness, what are you opening up to? So that's become the question that been most alive for me in the last few years. When I let go, let go, let go, let go, what what happens? Because it isn't that you get to nothingness, because then it's annihilationism, which is one of the near enemies of the Dharma. And my sense is that one opens up into wonder, one opens up into mystery, one opens up into the not-knowing mind. And of course the not-knowing mind can seem the opposite of satipatthana, because it's all about knowledge and understanding. And yet we get to this point where I think it's really important to let go even of understanding and of knowledge. Does that make sense? Okay. It's like, what is it you're opening up to? I think it's faith. I think this is where faith comes in very strongly. We're all here because we've tasted something directly, or else we wouldn't be here. Every single one of us has chosen to come on a Buddhist retreat because there's something that's been awakened in us that will have the quality of longing, some kind of longing. So I think that's what you open up to, this kind of longing, wonder, mystery. I can know and I can let go of knowing. So it's all very paradoxical and contradictory. I think sometimes the Zen tradition is edging into this kind of territory. But even Tenzin Palmo's thing, the more you realise there's nothing to realise. I mean, this book is called The Direct Path to Realisation. So how does that work? You know, we've been told this is a direct path to realisation, but she's saying there's nothing to realise. So I think it gets very exciting at this point, where we do the practice, you know, with one of the expressions in Buddhism, as if your turban's on fire. You know, we don't know how long we've got, so you do the practice with incredible commitment and dedication, and then you do the practice to let go of everything and open up to something way, way, way bigger than what we can ever possibly understand with our limited human mind. I think Sangharakshita says somewhere about no self, because that's often Anattara's talked about as no self. And of course the danger there is we can get, people think they can get rid of the self. And we don't like the self, so we think, yippee, I can just, you know, kill off myself, because that's what the Buddha told us to do. That's a real danger that many of us get into. But Sangharakshita says somewhere, rather than thinking of no self, imagine the self expanding infinitely. Is that correct? Anyone know? Any Dharma experts in the room?
Yeah, Marmaki, isn't it?
Marmaki, okay.
And no fixed self anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So it's shunyata or anatta. It's not no self, it's no fixed self. Such an important little word in there. So you're letting go of this idea that, you know, inside me there's some essential vidyamana-ness that will never change, that I'm flow. But I, of course I'm here. You know, I've got a body, I'm physical, I exist. So it's no fixed self. So I think it's really nice to imagine the self expanding infinitely rather than killing off the self. I think that's a really, really important point. And I'm also very fascinated at the moment. In the Heart Sutra, you've got these phrase, form is only emptiness and emptiness is only form. And I think many of us, we just focus on the first bit of that. Form is only emptiness. And you think, well, that's good. I can just get rid of all this horrible form and just be in this lovely, clear space. But what Avalokiteshvara saw directly is emptiness is only form. So actually this form is as real as the wide open space. So that's such a great thing to reflect on. We have to really love this conditioned form. Really, really love it. And love all the things in the world. And also let them flow through our fingers like water. I think that's what the Buddha's getting at. So everything I'm pointing to this morning is getting away from this refined reductionism and getting rid of and killing off and life is yucky and let's just, you know, go to paradise. It's all happening right here, right now, with a lot of love, a lot of depth, but learning to just... I like an image of living life as if it's water that's flowing through an open hand. And of course that's the gift of generosity. I mean, that's the gesture of generosity. Rather than a living life with a tight fist. I'm getting really hot talking about all this. So I think to go beyond the map, we have to listen, as I said yesterday, listen really, really deeply to what is calling us Yeah, I have a very strong sense that the universe is always calling us. Now, of course, that's completely open to misinterpretation. So take that as a metaphor. There isn't, you know, a God out there calling us. But I do strongly believe that what we perceive is only a microscopic fragment of what's happening, and that there's all these other dimensions happening all the time. And this, there is some, this longing that we feel, we can talk of as if the universe is calling to us. So, you know, I've realized from my own practice, I really, really needed to do this retreat, because this is helping me get off the map. And the reason I'm doing this retreat is because I had a calling at the convention last year when I was in the exhibition of Naga City's work. I think that's an example of a listening and a calling. I mean, it was beautiful work, but there was something way, way beyond that that was going on. And it's like, I need this. I need to enter this world of the imagination in order to get off the map. And I've not had such a satisfying week for a very, very long time. But it makes me cry. There's something in me that is so deeply moved by stepping off the map and falling into mystery. But it's because I listened. You know, I could have said, well, it's a nice exhibition, and gone off and had a cup of tea. But something kind of leapt out of my heart, like a dragon. I thought, oh God, you know. It was like I was trembling. So we all have these experiences. So I think this deep listening is really, really important. So I'll just talk a little bit about conditionality now, because I think this is really, really important. And this is what distinguishes the Dhamma's verses from the other verses. So in all the other verses, you're asked to be aware of the presence or absence of a particular thing. So it might be being aware of the presence or the absence of greed, the presence or the absence of hatred. But in the Dhamma's verse, you're asked to be aware of the presence or absence of, say, the hindrance of sensual desire. But I'll just read it out to you, because it's very, very significant, this. You're asked to be aware not only of that, but something more. And how, monks, does he, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas? Here, in regard to dhammas, he abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the five hindrances. If sensual desire is present in him, he knows, there is sensual desire in me. If sensual desire is not present in him, he knows, there is no sensual desire in me. And he knows how unarisen sensual desire can arise, how arisen sensual desire can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed sensual desire can be prevented. Yeah, and all the different verses have got that aspect of not only knowing the presence or absence, but where did it come from? And how can I create conditions in my life where the difficult things won't arise and the awakening factors will arise. So we're being asked to reflect much, much more deeply. And this comes, one of the really core things from Buddhism is this phrase, one who sees dependent co-arising sees the Dharma. That was one of the core insights of the Buddha. And sometimes it's said, this being that becomes, with the arising of this that arises, this not being that does not become, with the ceasing of this that ceases. And sometimes said that is the whole Dharma, this idea of conditionality. So we're not living in a random universe. We're living in a universe with laws or orders of existence. Yeah, and one of those is karma, which is willed action. So we're particularly looking at the karmic level with this sutta. Yeah. So I'm just going to say a wee bit to conclude about how taking your practice into your whole life is absolutely essential. So what I sometimes call it mindfulness in daily life. So you might think that your main practice happens on the cushion. And I think I might have said the other day, you might meditate for an hour a day, and that's quite a lot for most of us. And then you're asleep for maybe 8 hours. So 23 minus 8 is what? 16 or something?
15.
15, thank you. That means you've got 15 hours. And how you behave in those 15 hours is going to have a huge conditioning effect on your mind and your heart. And it will have a huge conditioning effect on how you are when you come back to your cushion the next day. And my observation is for many people, if not most people who are meditating in the modern world, our meditation, our daily meditation practice is essentially a salvage operation of the wreckage of the day before. We're not really meditating. We just sit to meditate and we're like, we're knackered, we're stressed, we're worrying. And it takes our whole practice just to come back to neutral. Feel a bit, wee bit better. We might have an intention, you know, I'm going to maintain this. Within about half an hour, we've got the phone on, we've got the computer on, we're multitasking, yelling at the kids, getting to work. And that just gets worse and worse as the day goes on. And we go to bed thinking, oh God, I'm completely blown it yet again. Maybe we have restless sleep because we're so stressed, get up in the next morning and we're just back into just trying to salvage some kind of semblance of, you know, humanity from this crazy life we're leading. So I've done a huge amount of work around mindfulness in daily life. It's one of the really big things we do at Breathworks. And I would say it's changed my life more than meditation. I always enjoy saying that because it's kind of shocking. But it's been more, I would say, if you think of this image that we're a great big ocean liner and we're full of habits and we're going along full throttle and then we're trying to turn that around to go in a slightly a different, we're going somewhere else rather than just going towards suffering, we're trying to go towards freedom. You know, to turn around an ocean liner is a very complicated activity, I believe. You've got to put all the engines in reverse thrust, you've got to slow it down, it's got huge momentum. And meditation on its own, there's no way I could have made any impact on my ocean liner. It was so happy going along full throttle towards suffering. But it's taking it off the cushion. So I'm just going to say the things that I do that have massively affected my quality of life. And I believe when I'm way happier and more peaceful than I was 20 years ago. So something's happened. And they're really ordinary things. So do not underestimate the power of ordinary things. Yeah, none of them are extraordinary. So it's obviously it's meditating, that is an aspect of it. It's having regular exercise. So I need to both do my stretches every day and I need to go swimming regularly. So I need to keep my body flexible and I need to keep my body fit. And now I'm not talking about, you know, major workouts. I'm talking about 20 minutes of stretching and I'm talking about 20 minutes of swimming two or three times a week. So you know, you don't need to go to the gym and work out for hours. We just need to keep the body as fit as possible. It's going to trying to have regular sleep, and that means discipline. Going to bed at more or less the same time, being disciplined about what you do before you go to bed, you know, not being on your computer late at night, not taking your phone to bed with you. So it's, you know, just very simple things, but having a routine. Routine is a great friend of awakening. And I'm not naturally a person who likes routine, but I have become a complete routine lover. Because then the body and the mind can settle, because it's not continually having to try and decide what to do next. Having a good diet. Yeah. So I don't have any, I don't do any special diet, but just eating three meals a day. You know, eating regularly, eating well. That's such a support to our practice. And the main thing that has changed my life is what I call pacing. So my back gets worse if I sit for long periods of time. So when I'm working, I use a timer. And after 20 minutes, I stand up. And I just have a stretch and then I sit down again. What I used to do, and I think this is what most of us do most of the time, I would sit until I was in absolute agony and couldn't sit anymore. And then I'd just be wrecked for the rest of the day. And I think we bring this attitude of doing something until we can't do it anymore to a lot of our activities. You know, doing the housework, gardening. You know, we're always pushing the envelope, which means we're always stressed, we're always tired, and we've not got anything in reserve. So standing up after 20 minutes, that has completely transformed my life. And that's not a special thing. That's a really simple, simple thing. So I went from being somebody who could maybe sit at a desk for 2 hours a day and then spend the rest of the day in bed, to being a person who can work all day by pacing my activities in that kind of way. I've learned to accept the help of others. I think that's something that a lot of us aren't very good at. Because why not? People want to help. It's going to benefit me. So why would I not allow them to do that? It's pride. So letting that go and just letting people help me and support me, that's been very important. And then having treatment. So I have acupuncture and osteopathy and things like that regularly. That has really helped my body. And obviously it costs money, and I know not everyone can afford it, but I will do that before anything else. You know, I'll do that before holidays, I'll do that before new clothes. I'll just make sure that's an absolute priority. So you will have your own version of those things. But what I'm saying to you, I don't think you'll drop into awakening and love and mystery and freedom unless you overhaul your whole life. Whatever that means. Adjust in these little ways. And I remember years ago Sona saying it when he gave a talk, if you can't meditate, look at your life, not your meditation. Because it's all conditioned. Yeah. What is it about your life that's preventing your mind being settled in meditation? So that's one way that we can take away why is the Buddha bringing into this last section that everything's conditioned? You have an experience, hasn't come from nowhere, it arose from previous conditions. Look at those previous conditions. If it's something that's destructive, what can you do to change those conditions so that it won't arise in the future? If you're having an experience that's really positive and expansive, where did that come from? What did you do that gave rise to that arising, and how can you put conditions in your life to bring about the future arising of these positive experiences? So yeah, I think those were the two things I wanted to say, really. So seeing into the lakshanas and seeing into conditionality, that's the essential takeaways from this part of the sutta. Yeah. Maybe I'll just say one last little thing. My own sense is that we all have moments of insight. We all have moments of awakening. I think we can think it happens to other people, it's some massive big experience, and that we're absolutely miles away. I don't really think that's the case. You know, I don't think we'd be here unless we'd had some kind of heart response to the Dharma. And we only have a heart response if we recognize it. Mm. We think, oh yes, I know that. I've had a hint of that, I had a taste of that. And I think the real work for most of us is, well, how do we build on those experiences, but also how do we integrate them into daily life? I think having the experience is the easy bit. And then how do we integrate it into our life so that we can absorb it and we can live aligned with it more and more deeply? And I think mindfulness is a very safe way to practice because it's very steady. It's very gentle. It's just bit by bit by bit. You're really in your body. You're really in your breath. You're very grounded. You're very present. So if you follow the mindfulness path, I think it's unlikely you're going to be sort of derailed by some major thing that knocks you sideways. I think there'll just be moment by moment, little moments of awakening that will get absorbed and integrated. But body awareness, breath awareness, being present, being aware of the senses is really, really important and grounding. Okay, so we'll leave that there. And we're going to do things in a little bit of a different order this morning. We're going to start in here by doing a body scan.